public schooling. That's the core evil. And that's why I love this podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is February 26th, and last week I had the pleasure of attending the 2014 New Hampshire Liberty Forum. I really just wanted to go and relax, socialize, maybe have a couple of nice dinners with friends. I managed to accomplish all of those goals, but I also had the opportunity, Osborne and I had the opportunity, to do a few sit-down interviews. So we had a couple of repeats, fan favorites who returned, Derek J. Freeman and Jeffrey Tucker, but we also got to have a conversation with a good friend of mine and friend of the show, Carlos Morales, who does the Truth Over Comfort podcast, and that's what you're going to hear today. Carlos has some experience with child protective services, and that is the focal point of our conversation after a long casual lead-in. I should tell you that these Liberty Forum interviews, I don't know what it is, it's something about the atmosphere, they have a little bit of a looser, freer feel than some of maybe the more structured interviews you've heard on the show in the past. I'll tell you the Jeffrey Tucker one is insane. I debated putting it in the AV Club because it is just so, if an interview could be prescribed ADHD medication, it is this one. So I'll release it. And if you're a big Jeffrey Tucker fan, look for that in a few days. Hey, you heard me mention something called the AV Club. Are you participating in that? I hope you'll consider it. You go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV. You can sign up and you can get access to so much amazing stuff. Toot toot goes my own horn, folks. You know what I mean? I'm really proud of what we put together in this bonus content section. And I hope you'll check it out. We ask for $6 a month. Supports the show, helps us out. I've got a list that is constantly lengthening of things that I need to get. So I hope you enjoy these next three shows. And more stuff will follow with Thaddeus Russell and Wes Bertrand. And at Liberty Forum, I did a little bit of networking, and we might have some exciting guests down the line. So that's it. Here we go. So, Carlos, you've been on the show, or have I only been on your show?
I think you've only been on my show. Then he popped it up on your channel, though. So, you know.
Right. I was on your podcast when it was called Renegade Variety Hour, but now it is called Truth Over Comfort Podcast.
Yeah, so you found it at truthovercomfort.net.
Has anything changed with it, or is it still the same?
It's a little bit different. You know, we were doing a show that was essentially an hour, hour and a half, and I've kind of cut it down to maybe 10 to 20 minutes, just because, you know, as I've brought up before, I really hate whenever anyone feels like they're wasting any of their time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I like to really condense a lot of information into a small amount of time. Also, the main way I'm getting out a lot of the information is not through the podcast as much as it's just through YouTube videos. I've been doing just kind of a series recently on public schooling, which, of course, you've done many, many hours on. And I try to knock out the entire history of public schooling in 11 minutes. And someone said it was too long, which explains the YouTube community.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty well.
And you're doing it all on video as well, right?
Yeah, everything's also on video.
That's great.
Now, I'm concerned about the name of your podcast, this Truth or Comfort, Truth Over Comfort.
Yeah.
So like...
You can have truth and comfort at the same time, but it's more a matter of... I've had discussions with people in regards to religion or the state, and they have made blanket statements in regards to, yeah, but I mean... I kind of like how comfortable this is. I mean, or even if they don't say it exactly like that, I think there's this point of contention that people have with reality, where if they actually embrace reality, that'll get them out of their comfort zone. And I think that's legitimate. I think it's been brought up a few different times, that what prevents people from ever reaching, I guess, the truth is the fact that they're comfortable in their small groups and their small little... you know, with their parents or anything else.
In their bubbles or their
bubbles,
or their tunnels. And that's something I think that you try to make that a theme on the show since the show has that name.
Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, the vast majority of my episodes, I basically just cover specific topics which are controversial and kind of mainstream society. And I try to give them as much information as I possibly can. not as a matter of trying to treat people as if they're idiotic, because I definitely don't want to do that. And I think a lot of libertarian podcasters kind of do that to make it feel as if they're better than someone else. Just because I really do believe that knowledge is the only way we're going to ever be able to kind of move past the tyrannical cascades that, are running over
us. If you're concerned with truth over comfort, don't you want people to realize that you are, in fact, better than they are?
So truth over comfort or truth or comfort, is there really a difference? We
want
to get...
You want them both, but you want one on top of the other.
Right, yeah. Right.
So like you like pie and ice cream, but you want the ice cream on top of the pie.
Well said.
Well, essentially, I did this one episode in regards to dishonesty.
Yeah.
And dishonesty was a topic that's very interesting to me because, I mean, I found points in my own life where I was lying in order to make people feel as if I was something that I wasn't. And what I really noticed was the fact that the reason why I was lying is because I wasn't comfortable with myself, with the human being that I've become. And I find a lot of individuals make up statements in regards to themselves because they're afraid of who they really are, because they kind of hate themselves. So I think by embracing the truth and reality of who you are, living consciously, you can actually make changes in your own life so that when you go out outside of your comfort zone to meet new people, you can actually be honest with them and not feel like, oh, I'm a jackass because I have a crappy job.
Yeah, and you got to hug. I put in this clip of Robert Downey Jr. talking about his experience with addiction in one of the self-esteem shows that Wes and I did. And he called it hugging the cactus.
Yeah, you got to hug.
You got to hug the cactus first.
Didn't he get that from Mel Gibson, though?
Yeah, you got it from Mel Gibson, who's hugged a cactus or two. You know? And
hugging a cactus is better than hugging a Jew.
That's an old saying.
Isn't that what he said?
It's an old saying. I know. You know, it really, Mel Gibson, all the problems that he's had, it really made me think about him in a different light, that story that Robert Downey Jr. told, that he was so helpful and understanding. And
we usually don't get mad at people for yelling at the cops. I think it was maybe just the way that he decided to yell at the cop by calling her something tits or something. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe the word tits was in there. The word Jew, as Osborne hinted at, was definitely in part of his tirade.
Subtle, so
well, if you take a look at like his history, his father and the whole cult thing in regards to that, they started their own like Catholic church or something, so that's interesting.
Really?
Now, that would be a tough thing to do.
Basically, there was a separation of Catholics after Vatican II.
Yeah, okay.
And so they kind of took a different stance in regards to that, and took a really like a harder stance, like basically kept the I hate fags and Jews part. They basically run off that motif: I hate fags and Jews and God's awesome, and that explains Passion of the Christ.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. Now, first of all, I just want to say for the audience, these Liberty Forum interviews, we don't sit down and say, this is what needs to happen. Here's an outline that everyone has been emailed. We sit down, we turn on the microphones, and we see what happens. And I think that kind of shows the fun of the event for the people who aren't here. Right?
Yeah.
Anything can happen. We've talked about pie. Jews.
Jews.
Yeah, we've talked about your podcast a little bit, but you were actually invited here to speak about something that I admit I haven't devoted enough time and attention to on my show, and that's...
something which is horribly scary.
Yeah.
You know, like when you're a kid and you're scared of airplanes because you don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling that CPS is still going to be scary, even after you tell us about it.
It actually gets a little bit more horrifying. So I used to be a Child Protective Service investigator in the state of Texas.
Yeah.
Actually, right after I quit, I started my podcast, but I didn't bring up the fact that I was an investigator until I moved out to Asheville, North Carolina, where I'm helping out with the Blue Ridge Liberty Project over there.
Yeah.
And the reason why was because I was afraid of legal issues in regards to Child Protective Services. And I'll explain a bit regarding activists and how they've kind of went against them in many, many cases.
Cool. So how are you organizing your talk? I mean, I think this is a good place to speak on that issue. But actually, before we even talk about what you're going to do tomorrow, this is a good place to speak on that issue because you get a lot of people already on your side. But you've done some stuff in North Carolina as outreach for this. So you want to tell us a little bit about that first?
Yeah. So me and Justin Stout run a group called the Blue Ridge Liberty Project in Asheville, North Carolina, which is a voluntarist group. It's a little bit different than a Free State Project in that I guess we are going towards a specific niche, which is voluntarist, which means no working within the government whatsoever.
Yeah.
No politics at all. Peaceful parenting and essentially going against any religions which are antithetical to the non-aggression principle, which includes all the Abrahamic religions. Mm-hmm. So we are going to that particular type of niche. And, you know, we've had a lot of good moves, good people moving to the Blue Ridge Liberty Project, but also a lot of outreach online. And what I've been doing recently is lectures kind of at bookstores and places like that, even people's apartments, whomever will basically have me in regards to child protective services. Because, you know, if you're going to be coming out and saying things like we need to legalize cannabis, or mm-hmm. that we need to do unschooling, or that I'm anti-government, you're going to need to be prepared for those repercussions. And one of the most unconstitutional and just illegitimate organizations that works within the government is actually Child Protective Services. And if you knew what they could actually do to a family with so little evidence, it's really important that people are actually prepared if CPS comes after them.
Yeah, that's a great concern that people with young children should think about. And I mean, it varies from state to state.
Yeah.
Do you want to say where you were involved in it?
Yeah, I was in San Antonio, Texas.
Okay. So did you get the sense that Texas was particularly worse, better, somewhere in the middle?
You know, it's funny, when I was working for them, because I saw so much bureaucracy and corruption and just pretty, you know, a lot of times we like to say we shouldn't be blaming the people who are working within the system. Like, you don't want to blame the soldiers for the war. Mm. But I met some of the worst human beings I've ever met as a child protective service worker. So I assumed that Texas was the worst. But then I heard stories from people in Utah, North Carolina, and Vermont, because basically I let up my phone number one day and I just get phone calls. I help people at CPS. And there's this little thing called the Fourth Amendment, which is essentially that a law enforcement officer, for instance, or any government worker can't just walk into your house without a warrant. And that's a big deal. That's something you must understand, is they do not have the right to do so, especially child protective service workers. But in North Carolina and these other states that I mentioned, CPS workers are just walking into people's houses, like just walk, opening up the door, walking straight in and stating things like, you know, this is a tough part of my job, but I'm going to have to ask you some questions because I fear a child might be in danger. And just walking into people's houses. And the thing is that when it involves your kids, you're so much more likely to listen to every single word that the CPS worker is stating, mm-hmm. as if it's canon, as if they're not lying to you. You know, when I was working for CPS, we were told not to let the parents know about their rights. I mean, they stated that categorically. There's something called a safety plan, for instance, which is supposedly set up to protect the child. If there's not going to be a removal, essentially, they'll give you a piece of paper and it says, you have to do this, this, and this in order to not have your child removed. And they make it sound as if you have to sign it. The truth of the matter is that you don't. In fact, if you sign it, you're essentially stating that you are guilty. And if you break any of the insane parameters, then parameters could be like the grandma has to be in the room whenever you're with your baby, even at 2 a.m. If you break any of those parameters, even if it's just an allegation a CPS worker didn't see it, you can have an immediate removal because you are breaking law now.
Mm-hmm.
So really, the first bit of information, don't sign anything.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is a trend we see with the police as well, that people who are perceived as easy targets are obviously getting the worst of this. So, you know, people who are poor, minorities, maybe English isn't their first language. So, yeah, I think obviously we see low-income people getting the worst of this.
Poverty is seen as a form of abuse in child protective services. Nancy Schaefer, a congresswoman who passed away in the last few years, she really made a strong case for that, and I saw it all the time. You know, if a kid was sleeping on a bed, oh, well, you know, that's negligence. You know, a bed that's on the floor. But it's like, well, you know, these people are poor, and they're probably taking care of these kids better than a foster home would.
Yeah.
But the what Child Protective considers abuse is insane. So as a CPS investigator, I did more to promote the drug war than I did the war on, than the war on child abuse.
Yeah.
Vast majority of our cases were, one, false allegations. But if they weren't false allegations, they were allegations of abuse that involved drug use.
Let's talk about false allegations for a minute. Okay. Can you just define what that is?
Okay, so a false allegation can be one of two things.
Mm-hmm.
It can be either the person is purposefully making a statement that they know is incorrect.
Yeah.
In order to scare a family or basically destroy another family. So they'll call CPS. So let me bring you up some examples of they know they're lying.
Okay.
neighbor in one of these cases, right? He called up, he was having an argument with one of his neighbors, right? And his kid, because his kid, according to him, was a little brat. Not exact wording, but now the neighbor then called Child Protective Services and alleged that this person was part of the Mexican mafia, that they were selling cocaine and heroin, and that there was hookers in the household. Now, I went out, and whenever I read allegations that were that absurd, like that many different things, especially Mexican mafia, I've never met any Mexican mafia. I was always so excited to meet Mexican mafia. Whenever I was just like, do they wear suits? So I went out there, and I mean, I saw none of this. We drug tested, found no drugs whatsoever, went through the house. I actually went with cops. We went with cops when we went there. Whenever there's any signs of like they might have guns, you sometimes bring cops with you. So I went through the house, nothing whatsoever. Ended up talking to the neighbor. And after just a long conversation, he basically goes like, well, I mean, yeah, I might have come up with some of the stuff, but I really have concerns. I was like, concerns? You just said they're doing cocaine and heroin with hookers. Basically, it was like Wolf of Wall Street going on in their house, but with Mexicans. And it was absolutely absurd. So we had cases like that. And what's even worse, there'd be parent separations, right? There are people going through a divorce. And a mom, what she could do is make an allegation of sexual abuse by the father. Because sexual abuse is one of those hard things to disprove. Uh-huh. And I say disprove instead of prove, because an allegation is considered evidence at Child Protective Services, especially in regards to sexual assault.
Yeah.
And so the mother could just get complete sole custody in these cases. Now, in the state of Texas, the sexual assault stuff is handled way better than in other states. Because in the state of Texas, if there's a sexual assault charge, you bring a child into a third-party center in which they actually talk to a therapist who knows what they're doing, who actually is able to gather evidence, and that's how they get their information. Because they don't want to traumatize the kid even more. But in other states, investigators, who I will explain in a bit, have very little training, will ask questions like, where did he touch you? Which is a leading question. How many times did he touch you? That's a leading question.
Was it Janet Reno? Isn't that how she made her name? By doing these kind of operations?
Yeah, she had leading questions.
Fabricating
evidence. So those are the cases of false allegations in which it is purposeful by the person. Now,
here's the interesting. Okay, I mean, this is ahead. Just such a sad part of this is that people seem to know that, or maybe I'm speculating a little bit, but I'm curious. People seem to know that, like, if you have a problem with your neighbor, you can't call the police and be like, yeah, this guy's a Mexican drug lord. But it's like okay to call CPS because there's another layer of the investigation. That you know, these people, you can't, cops just can't come and shoot up somebody's house, right? Because then you can, well, they certainly can and they certainly do. What I'm saying is, it seems safer. Like CPS is a safer weapon to use against people because it gets them sucked into this investigation. Where if you make a false report to the police and the police come and find out it's a false report, you're probably going to jail for what you did. So were there any consequences in that story you were telling before we move on about the Mexican drug lord hooker allegation?
No, it's funny what can be considered consequences, because all the person has to state is like, well, I thought that was happening. So, okay, well, we'll just go and throw the case. It's ruled out, right? And that same neighbor can make that allegation again 3 weeks later, and we'll have to go back out there and investigate again.
Yeah.
Now it gets even worse than that. Because a reporter could be anonymous, right? As in, they don't even tell CPS. Now, if it's the same person seven times, every single time it's rolled out, the supervisor can close the case before it even goes to investigations. But if it's anonymous, I can keep going out again and again and again and again for the exact same allegations, traumatizing this kid repeatedly because they keep on going, you sure your parents aren't using cocaine? You sure they're not using heroin? Have you ever seen any hookers around the house? If you ask a kid seven or eight times, he's probably going to think, Maybe that is going on in my house. I'm not sure.
Well, you're an official. Do you have a windbreaker that has... Usually, the bureaucracies give their people who have to go out and visit others windbreakers with the initials of the bureaucracy on it.
So the reason why we don't do that is because we're not allowed to hold guns. And windbreakers, say Child Protective Services, seems like a really bad idea in the ghetto.
Sure.
I spent a lot of time in impoverished areas in San Antonio, and it's an incredibly impoverished place. You have a lot of social stratification because you have a lot of illegal immigrants, things like that. Mm-hmm. And what was really sad is I was in pretty much every high school, public public school that's in San Antonio. I've visited every single one of them because that's where we ask kids questions. You'd ask someone and they go, oh, yeah, that girl's a bitch, so I fucking called CPS on her. Mm-hmm. Like that. And it's just like, you made up allegations of abuse because someone was a bitch to you. Like, they use it, poor people use it as a weapon. Mm-hmm. It's it was absolutely tragic. And I've heard 13-year-olds, 12-year-olds tell me things like that.
Wow.
So everybody's using this system because no one ever gets in trouble if it's fake.
Yeah. So this, I'm confused, though, because one thing I know about bureaucrats is they are horribly lazy, right? So what drives them to go investigate these silly allegations that they know aren't valid?
So Child Protective Services only stays afloat if there's a certain amount of allegations that are made per each year. There has not been statements made categorically if a certain amount are proven each year, if you get more money for that or not. But we do know for a fact the more and more allegations you have, the more it seems as if child abuse is incredibly rampant. So Child Protective Services actually doesn't gain money if it prevents child abuse. It only gains money if child abuse is everywhere.
Okay, so it's the managers who want to increase their empire.
Yeah,
they're forcing the agents to go do the work.
The incentive structure is the root of all evil when it comes to Child Protective Services. I mean, outside of the terrible training by Child Protective Service investigators, the incentives are where it gets really bad because, again, Child Protective Services only stays afloat if there's a certain amount of allegations made every single year, right? Which is why they strike out regards to the drug war, because it's the easiest one to do.
Sure. Yeah, I think we often talk about bureaucracies and just the state generally as having no incentives, lacking incentives to serve people, which is true. They don't. They lack customer service incentives, but their incentives are about essentially a bureaucracy is created,
yeah,
usually unnecessarily, usually in response to another problem that was, you know, somehow created by the state. Right. So I think obviously I'm not suggesting that Child Protective Services was, created because of some other problem with the state, but it does happen frequently. You know, you could make that argument. You could, there are contributory factors, but, you're looking.
Well, I don't know. When it comes to bureaucracies and like you're discussing incentives and how. You know, I love Jeffrey Tucker,
sure.
But he'll talk about the state as if like, well, they're just incompetent and lazy and they don't get to do any single thing positive for society, which is true. But then he states like, and they do everything wrong. Well, Child Protective Services and public schooling are doing what is right.
They're killing it. Yeah.
Yeah, they're killing it. I mean, literacy is abundant and Child Protective Services is raking in children left and right. I wanted to get a bit more back to that incentive structure, though.
Yeah, well, I'd say they have incentives to justify their existence. Once the bureaucracy is created, usually in some kind of damage control or not striking at the root of a problem situation, after that, their sole purpose, or their main purpose, I should say, not their sole purpose, is to justify the existence of the bureaucracy itself. So what we're talking about is incentives to have complaints and investigations.
Yeah, and there's a few other structures though within Child Protective Services. So people usually bring up the investigators, mm-hmm. but we got to also think about the foster homes. Foster homes is where it gets really greasy, because of course foster homes involve a lot of money. So I remove a kid from a house, right? Usually you stick them in temporary housing, and then they end up in a foster home, right? Now a foster home gains more money for every single kid they get,
mm-hmm.
and that's. That makes some sense, right? It costs money to deal with a kid. They also get more money for every single medical diagnosis a child gets, which, mm-hmm. if you're paralyzed, makes sense. You got to bring that kid to the hospital all the time. He might have infections. Makes sense. But the diagnosis doesn't necessarily mean paralyzed. It can mean a mental issue. Now, let me set up a scenario real quick. You're 5 years old. You've just been taken out of your house, your community, your church, your city. Right, you've just been stuck in a foster home, and now you're in some other public school that you hate. You're with all these other kids that you don't know who are probably abusing you. So you might have some issues sleeping. You might have temperamental issues. You might yell at people on occasion. And, you know, you might even kind of hallucinate that you're remembering things that didn't actually occur.
Yeah.
Which, again, you're tired. I mean, if you haven't slept for 3 days, you go nuts. So we would look at that and go, we need to help this kid out. He obviously needs some therapy. Maybe we can get his parents back in his life. But according to a state doctor, That child has oppositional defiant disorder, ADHD, bipolar disorder, insomnia, and schizophrenia. And there's 6 to 8 medications for that. And there's more money for every single one of those diagnoses. I've had 7-year-old kids who are on more than 7 medications for supposed mental illnesses. And they are completely zombified. I mean, they feel nothing. And again, that even works for the foster home because now he's not yelling. He's not screaming. He's just sleeping all day. And you're raking in a good amount of cash. Now, this is, I know that can come off as kind of Alex Jones-ish, but the incentive structure is real.
It lines up perfectly with the experience that I had in a boarding school. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that a lot of those kids, I don't want to try to ascribe percentages to it, but it seemed like most of them had been through foster care.
Yeah.
And most of them who had come through foster care had been abused or neglected there. Right. Yeah. Now, because I ran, the last 2 years I worked at this school, I ran a campus. So obviously I was pretty immersed in the files of these kids, the histories of these kids, because it was really, it was important to the whole environment because, you know, the place I worked was kind of like a push-off. Like it was supposedly, it was centered around kids who had what was called sexually reactive behavior issues. And basically they had been sexually abused and they, psychologically speaking, had just become these ticking clocks or ticking bombs to replicate their abuse on somebody else when they reached the age. Usually the way it seemed like it worked was they would reach the age of their abuser and then abuse somebody close to the age they were when they were abused.
Yeah.
So I had to, when I call my campus a push-off, kids, they would say, oh, you're going to Vail. You're bad. It was called the Vail campus. They'd say, you've been bad. You're going to Vail for 2 weeks with the nuts, with the really crazy, nutty kids, you know, who are walking around with their hands in their pants, that kind of stuff. And it wasn't as bad as people made it out to be, but it was a punishment. It was a punishment for kids and staff to be sent to this place. So if a new kid came in, I had to see how whatever their issues were, how that was going to affect the environment that we would try to stabilize. We would try to get like a mix. We'd try to get things settled. And then somebody new would come in or somebody would leave or 2 new kids would come in. So I had to be in their histories. And I had a psychologist who was helping me with this. But these problems of foster care and neglect and abuse in foster care, usually worse than whatever happened to them that got them taken out of their own homes.
So children are 6 times more likely to die in foster homes than they are if they were left in an abusive household.
Yeah. I mean, most of what was called abuse, you're right, was the parents were poor. And they, I don't want to say that it was, oh, they were always just smoking pot. Like some of them could have probably been crack addicts,
meth
addicts. Yes.
Meth. And the worst thing, of course, about meth is whenever you cook it in your house, there's a lot of kids die often. So there is abuse that exists. Absolutely. A lot of children are abused. It's just a big reason why we're going out for also the drug war is because, of course, in America, physical abuse is tolerated. They call it spanking, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, the vast majority of parents do it. So it's hard to prove. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you left a bruise on, say, their butt or that kind of area, that was called a non-vital area. So it was like, oh, well, I accidentally messed up and hit him a bit too hard. That wouldn't be considered abusive. Now, of course, I understand, you know, child abuse is absolutely real. And people bring up to me, well, what are we going to do if we get rid of child protective services? How are we going to end child abuse? And that's like asking a libertarian, how are we going to replace the IRS and the CIA and the DEA? It's asking two contradictory questions. Yes, there will always be drug users. No, we do not need the DEA. The child protective services is incentivized to essentially kidnap children and throw them in foster homes. And those foster homes are incentivized to drug those kids. And the judges in these particular cases, the judge right in family court. Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, in family court, you're not in front of a court of your own peers. It's just a judge who, by his own whim, can just say, yeah, that was abusive and you're going to be stuck in a foster home. Judges have the same incentive because they are paid by the same people that pay CPS. It all goes through family law. So everyone here essentially has an incentive to really kind of screw you over on that end. So when you're dealing with child protective services, it's important to realize the fact that this is an agency which hurts. It does not harm. They hamper freedom. They do not help society whatsoever. And to realize whenever a child protective service investigator comes in your life that they're very, very likely to manipulate your words. So to be very cautious.
Yeah. And you know, they're targeting, like I said before, low-income people who they've identified as less educated, less capable of defending themselves intellectually. Obviously, I'm sure you're encountering quite a bit of English as a second language.
Yes.
Where people are easily misled or confused. And
the information we get for people to sign, it wasn't in Spanish. I was in San Antonio. The vast majority of people there spoke Spanish. A good percentage, I mean, well over 50% of the people that go into their homes, they didn't. They only spoke Spanish. A lot of them were legal immigrants.
Yeah.
And now, according to the state of Texas and any other state in the United States, the state owns the child. The parent does not own the child, even in the case of illegal immigrants. So essentially, these people that don't speak English, who are illegal immigrants, they're afraid as hell of the government. So they're willing to sign any piece of paperwork if it means that, oh, I'm not going to get in trouble. But again, as I brought up, a safety plan is a minutes of guilt. Signing over your medical records is essentially a minutes of guilt. They're only hurting themselves by keeping in this situation. And of course, they can't afford a family court attorney, which if you go to legal, if you go to court and you don't have a family court attorney, you're screwed. I've seen judges laugh in the face of parents whose children have just been removed because they were dressed badly. Okay. Family court is one of the situations that's so impossible to understand. You know, no one in the United States knows every single law, right?
Right.
But when it comes to family law, it's so convoluted that the only way you're going to get through is by having a good family court attorney. And it's the only way a judge is going to respect you whatsoever because it means you have some money.
Yeah.
That means you can actually litigate. It means you can actually protect someone. When it comes to when people talk about the top 1% and things like that, I don't necessarily buy into all of it. But when it comes to family court, the rich don't get screwed.
No, yeah, and obviously they're the people who are there the least. And
I never saw any white people working for Child Protective Services. As in, I never walked in any white person's house the entire time I worked there. I mean, once. It's still like 45% of the population of San Antonio, and it was all Hispanics and black people.
45%? These whites are 45% of the population? Okay.
And I never saw the whites.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
If you take I can't remember the specific statistics. I'm sure you can look it up afterwards. But a vast majority of the children in foster homes are black. And if you actually look at the percentages of the United States population, I think it's like, what, 10%? 10% of the U.S. population is black?
Yeah.
I mean, it's astronomical numbers-wise.
No, it was the makeup of the school that I worked at. It was interesting because it was in Vermont. It was like southwestern Vermont. And we would take kids from Vermont. But the other places we took kids from, Washington, D.C., Providence, Rhode Island, New York City, Baltimore. Yeah. So it was an interesting mix of kids. Now, obviously, people should know that up here, there are far less black people. So most of the people on welfare, most of the people in foster care in this area, from my experience, are white. But again, this kind of is about these are the people who get targeted.
Yeah.
Minorities and people who speak English as a second language.
They're the easiest to do. I mean, you're dealing with people with a very, very low level of education who have just kind of gotten used to government agents being in and out of their lives, especially if, say, they're on welfare or they've had issues with police before. So they might even think like, oh, this is just kind of like how the police work, right? You just come in here. I mean, they're not even taking my kid right now, so I'm fine.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
No, you're not. You just gave me your medical records and you just basically signed that you're guilty. You're not fine. There's a very good chance I can remove your kids pretty quickly.
Yeah, I remember Jamie Crane. I used to, a guy, you know, we all know who he is. He used to do volunteer work with a church in Oklahoma, and they would go to the city, and he would meet people of a variety of races living in the inner city in poor neighborhoods who were on welfare. And he said the concept of anything else, the concept of living a life where you're not dependent on the government, was inconceivable. Generation after generation. And of course, one generation feeds the next. I mean, I'm not saying it's an easy life, but obviously if you have no skills, getting welfare benefits, which are comparatively generous to like $8 an hour, you know, like you would choose welfare over $8 an hour.
So, yeah, there's something I feel kind of guilty about, but it's something I think it's a reality of whenever you work for an agency, which is on occasion you go, well, I'm team CPS right now and you're team poor people.
Yeah.
And so I'd walk into an occasion, right, where I knew this woman was abusing someone, their kids. And the mom would actually ask me, well, what can you do for me? Like, what services can you provide for me? Like, she's basically admitting she's hitting her kids and then asking me what the state can give her. And it was just so contradictory to me. And immediately clicked in my head. I was like, oh, you're just a leech on the system.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of mentality goes deep into child protective services, where you feel, because it's not as big an agency as, say, the police department. You feel like, oh, well, we're the hardworking hero team. And supervisors will cheer on people who get 4 or 5 removals in a week. They're like, oh my God, you're doing such a good job. You're really stopping child abuse out there.
So it becomes more like this attitude that I think people used to walk around the schools that I worked at. They said, this place would be great if it wasn't for these kids.
Yeah.
You know, like that was the big joke on Thursday afternoon. So is that kind of, you know, like, fuck these people. These people are shit. And obviously you want to, especially if you're talking about most work-related things with other people who work for CPS, you're kind of building this narrative with each other that we're the good guys. Obviously, you know, how else could you sleep at night?
Well, and if you look at the training, let me go into the training real quick. I hope we have a little bit of time.
I want to make sure we save about 15 minutes to talk about solutions, which I assume that you're going to offer people some defense strategies. Yeah. So go ahead.
As you're talking about that, I'm curious about the typical person who goes into this line of work, and how they do they start off being an asshole? Do they get turned into an asshole by the system? Because cops, I kind of understand, right? Like, oh, I want to go do this job where I get a badge and a gun and I tell people what to do and I get to take all their money and I can, you know, confiscate their assets. And it seems like a pretty good gangster type deal. I'm not clear on the CPS agent and what they get out of the whole thing, and why I would be interested in having that job, and then what happens to me when I get there.
So the reason why I chose to work for Child Protective Services was after a few real life altercations that I had with other individuals. Like, I saw a few people actually hitting their kids in public. I stepped in on them beating their kids. And one of the cases, I got physically assaulted for it. And I had people running up to me defending the father who was abusing the kid, right? Like, in public. It was really, really bad. So in my mind, I was like, I need to get in the trenches in order to prevent child abuse head on. And I thought at the time that Child Protective Services was a positive thing for that. So of course, it turned out it wasn't. So
and it was the only option that we have, because that responsibility of what you did, what you thought was your responsibility as a human being to defend a defenseless person, that's been outsourced. We've all been relieved of that, you know, through this agency.
Yeah. So I turned in my application and I was thrown right in, right? Now, you'd think that an investigator would have a lot of training in, say, child development psychology and dispute resolution, because they're supposed to be able to ask children questions without coaching them and having an understanding of a voice tone and body movement. You'd think they'd have it, obviously, in dispute resolution, because you're supposed to be able to decipher fact from fiction from a parent while regarding alleged abuse, while at the same time trying to not get punched in the face. And you'd also assume they had information on forensics, because you're supposed to be able to tell if a bruise came from a spank, a fall, or a punch. But no. Child Protective Service investigators, all you need is a bachelor's degree, literally anything. There was a guy with a saxophone degree from Berkeley, and 2 months of training. And then you're thrown right in, and from there you're able to do basically anything you want as long as it's okay with the supervisor.
Well, I'm encouraged to hear, well, no, that doesn't matter. God, look at me. I'm still programmed in some ways. I'm encouraged to hear they at least need a bachelor's degree. Strike that.
Don't you have this podcast called School Sucks?
You know, they have it is a saxophone degree.
No, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, I can only contrast the stories you're telling to my experience. And, you know, I started in 2000 in this line of work. I was a senior in college. And I was basically a line staff. The title of my job was a residential counselor. We lived in this it was a city in Vermont, but it was pretty rural, you know. And they would take people off the street. Hey, poor Vermont person, you want to make $8.50 an hour? And we would be given this access and this control over these kids who were in these incredibly fragile and often volatile states, and people who could be terrible parents in their own right, coming in making it with no background, like, oh yeah, I used to work at the factory before it closed, but now I'm a dorm staff. So for me, maybe there is a little bit of relief that any kind of psycho can't walk up. They at least have to show that they could sit still and listen to other people for an extra few thousand hours in college. But obviously, everything I've said about college still stands.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Whenever I put in a resignation, I got the full treatment, right? I had a number of different investigators go, well, you know, this job ain't for everyone, you know, that kind of thing. This, you know, it really takes a certain kind of person. And they're right. But the characteristics they were talking about were not correct. You have to be able to bow down to authority. You have to have a lack of empathy and sympathy. And I really mean that. I mean, I've seen people, caseworkers, make jokes in front of parents who are crying because they're going like, well, you shouldn't have screwed up. So that is a complete lack of empathy and sympathy. And you have to be able to act in contradiction of the truth, because I knew caseworkers who smoked cannabis and then they destroyed people's families because they were smoking cannabis. And they thought, well, you know, you got caught. Like, they just had to be able to justify evil left and right. And I really kind of mean that word evil, because what we did was barbaric.
So back to Osborne's question, did you get to know any of your coworkers?
Yeah.
Did you hang out with them? Did you kind of confide in them about some of the things with the job?
You know, I remember talking to a room of caseworkers, like we're all sitting at a table, we're eating lunch, and this is to tell you something. And they were like, well, what did you do last night? I was like, oh man, I was clicking around to Wikipedia, I ended up reading all these cool articles, whatever. And they all looked at me like I was insane. They were like, they were like, well, didn't you watch anything? I was like, I don't have cable. And they go, what do you do? What do you do when you get home? I was like, I don't really watch TV. And they're like, so does your, I was married at the time, does your wife, does she go on the Wikipedia too? The Wikipedia, like the gays. and just the, I mean, there was no critical thinking. None of the people that I met there. And I wanted like one guy. I mean, the entire time, you know, you always wanted this sense of community. Some sense of like, there's going to be one cool guy, right? Nothing. Just sociopaths. And God, I hate being so negative. But I have hope in individuals. I have no hope in bureaucracies.
Yeah.
And there's an interesting little tidbit. Over half of investigators quit within a year.
Yeah.
And then the people who stay after a year stay for like five.
Well, that's somewhat encouraging, right? Mm-hmm. Because
yeah.
I keep thinking of Milgram and I keep thinking of the Stanford prison experiments, yeah. Right? When you give people that power and not, I mean, Zimbardo, who did the Stanford prison experiment, talks about how if people mask their identity, right, they become more vicious. So I even saw this just watching video of a Keene school board meeting. Even if people are allowed to duck behind the law, or an agency, suddenly they are more aggressive and more forceful and more bloodthirsty, whether actually physically or not. But they just become darker people. You know what I mean? So I would think you would see that in an agency like this.
Well,
especially,
how sexy does this sound? Child Protective Services investigator. Like, you get to be called an investigator with 2 months of training. So basically, you have these people who are getting degrees in nothing. I mean, my degree was in sociology, which is a degree in jargon. It's completely worthless. And when I got out and I joined Child Protective Services, they were like, hey, here's $42,000. And if you stay here for like another 6 months, we'll jump up your pay. And if you stay here for like 4 years, you can make maybe $78,000 a year plus 55 cents on the mile. So it's a boatload of money. I mean, for people who essentially can't do anything.
Yeah, okay.
And so there's just such an incentive to stick around and go for Team CPS.
Yeah.
And
you're right. It is.
I want to say something positive, but I mean, I could say positive things about human beings, but I can't say much about CPS.
It is. Yeah. I could see how if you have, you know, maybe a limited. It is sexy. CPSI Miami.
Yeah,
very sexy.
I wonder if they just change the name something lighter. Although recently, I think it was in Arizona, where they said we're dismantling Child Protective Services completely. You know what they did? They renamed it. They kept the same people. You can't fire them. They all have tenure. I was like, how are they going to fire every single state worker? I was like, this is going to be the biggest protest of all time. And there wasn't a single like investigator protesting. I was like, oh, you just replaced them. And they've actually done that in a few other states.
Rebranding.
Rebranding. Mm-hmm. Texas did it a while back. It did absolutely nothing. You have the same bureaucracies. There's one positive thing, apparently, in Washington, D.C. recently, where they stated that you can't get a removal unless you get a court hearing, which is nice. Because we could get removals before we even told the parent that they were being investigated.
Wow.
Yeah, which is pretty disgusting.
So let's talk a little bit about defense strategies. Yeah, absolutely. I'm assuming that because most of the people that you're going to be addressing tomorrow are going to be sympathetic with all of the problems and horror stories and your experience and your decision to leave. But I guess looking at trends over the course of the last decade, we could say that this might become more of a threat for people who are living,
off the grid,
non-conformist lifestyles in the coming years. So, yeah, have at it. I mean, what should people know and which precautions should people take?
Well, first, of course, is to know what CPS is, which is essentially a domestic terrorist group that has not done a whole lot of positive things. Secondly, let everyone else know. If you're in a tight-knit community, you know, I'm with the Blue Ridge Liberty Project, right? We're a small community of families. Everyone knows the concerns with Child Protective Services, and they know not to rat out each other or even tell CPS anything, not even talk to CPS, okay? Let your kids know, too. Now, if your kid's in a public school, first off, get them out. But if you can't, let them know if an investigator comes to speak to them, don't talk to them whatsoever. Investigators are allowed to just go up to kids and just talk to them, right? Now, from there, if they don't have any information, reliable information, they're going to come to your house. Now, that's important to do here is, one, they're going to knock on your door if they're following the Fourth Amendment. They're going to ask to come in. They're going to say, I'm a special investigator. I need to go into your house, right?
Yeah.
First thing to do is to start recording the conversation instantly because Child Protective Service investigators don't write word for word. Instead, they take little notes and then they make a narrative story whenever they get back to their office, which you can imagine the biases and manipulation from there. So you're going to want to record. Next, don't let them into your house. There has been cases in which a few dirty pans are considered an unlivable condition for a child. Next, right after that, you can either say, you're going to have to talk to my family court attorney, but because that can raise suspicion, that can be cause for a warrant, according to CPS. So it is actually not a terrible idea to actually talk to them. Now, if you're going to talk to them, which you just kind of have to do, one thing is you're going to have to show them your child, like if your child's in the house, because they cannot close a case as ruled out, which means, you know, no allegations are proven true, until they see your kid. So you bring your kid out, you show them, hey, look, no bruises or anything else, and that's fine. Now, if you have any concerns regarding maybe there are some bruises on my kid, don't show them to the investigator. Instead, right after the case, right after this is done, after they leave, bring them to a doctor so that they can show that there's no bruising or anything else. And if there is bruising, then it's because of this particular case. Now, when you're actually speaking to them, of course, the most important thing is to not contradict yourself, ever. That's what they're actually looking for. And the thing is, it's easy to contradict yourself whenever you're talking. I've contradicted myself on the radio before, and I'm not even trying to lie or anything. It just happens.
Sure. Would you be allowed to videotape?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, at least in the state of Texas, West Virginia, Virginia, a few other states. You can check laws, although places like North Carolina, for instance, the family court laws are on like 12 different websites that aren't even put together. Like, you just have to go around. It's kind of nutty.
But, would your first encounter usually be a knock on the door, or would there be a letter and, you know,
a
phone call?
So yeah. I knock on the door. There's generally not a phone call. And the reason why is because you want to, according to the investigators, you want to make it so that the parent doesn't know what's coming.
That's what I figured. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want them to prep. But if you knock on the door, essentially there's priority two and priority one cases. Priority two means it's like negligence, but not too bad. It means you have to try to contact the parent every 72 hours. If it's priority one, it means like there's hardcore drug use or hardcore physical abuse. That means you have to check every single 24 hours. Now, so I knock on the door, right? And no parent shows up. I put a little note on the door. It says, please contact me immediately. You're being investigated by CPS. Now, if you do actually open up the door, we do begin talking. There's a few things you have to remember. One is do not admit to any prior drug use or alcohol use at all. Even if you did, I don't care. Don't tell them. If you have any prior history of domestic violence, I'm sorry if you were ever hit by your spouse. This Child Protective Service investigator is not your friend. They're not your therapist. They're not your psychiatrist. They're not going to help you. There has been cases in which there was a mother who admitted to being abused by her husband, who had been out of the home for 2 years, and they still got a removal case because they said the kid was in danger. So don't admit to anything in regards to that. there's also the fact that they're also going to ask you questions regarding, were you ever in a foster home? As long as that foster home was in another state, they'll never even be able to tell if that's the case. So you just don't tell them that you have been. If you have any prior history of Child Protective Services, if you live in a different state, they can't look up your history without a whole lot of work. So don't bring up any history in regards to that. There might be some other things. You seem to be wanting to ask a question here.
No, I'm just, do you have the option, or have you ever encountered or heard about a situation where somebody just refused to answer questions? I assume that would just be, recorded as incredibly suspicious behavior.
So yeah, it would be marked as incredibly suspicious. Here's the thing. A Child Protective Services investigator cannot get a warrant to go into a house if the report was anonymous. So that's always the lottery thing. It's like, if the reporter was anonymous, this case is probably just going to be closed. Yeah. But if it wasn't anonymous, there's that case. A lot of the advice I'm giving right now is regards to people who actually decide to speak to them. And in most of the cases, it's kind of important to do so. Can I go on just a little bit more of...
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So they're going to ask you, of course, if you're abusing your kid. You shouldn't be abusing your child, so obviously you're going to be going that route. They'll most likely also bring up things like paperwork. So basically, I'm stating all the things you shouldn't say. And by knocking out that entire list, all you should be really stating is, yes, I feed my child. No, I do not hit my child. Yes, my child is completely healthy. So those are the questions. Very, very simple. Say as little as possible on that end. Sign absolutely no paperwork whatsoever. They may ask for a drug test. There's these oral swab drug tests where they just swipe it in your mouth. Here's a little fun secret. They can't tell if you did any drugs 48 hours prior to the test. So if it's Friday and I smoked bongs and rips of weed and snorted cocaine off of hookers on Monday, they can't tell with that oral swab drug test.
So with the Mexicans, you did.
With the Mexicans, yeah. And heroin. I don't know why we mix both, but, we're crazy. Yeah. Anyway, if you did do drugs, though, you're not going to want to do the oral swab drug test. So what you're going to want to ask for is essentially they can get a court-mandated drug test, which is a urine test.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say whether or not you can fake one, but you can fake one. And online, you'll get a little tidbits regarding that.
Yeah.
But essentially, that will get you 90% of the way there. Now, there are different laws in different states and different technicalities. If you go, this will help out pretty much every single person, though, in every single state. Now, if you go to court, again, I have to urge every single person. Yes, family court attorneys are expensive. How many hours have you spent your entire life protecting your child, though? How many hours have you put in giving them a house, food, transportation, school, every single thing else? Think about all that work. It can go completely down the drain if you don't spend a little bit of money on that family court attorney, and you can destroy that child's life forever. So put the money in there for a family court attorney. There's a fantastic website called FightCPS.com. Again, that is FightCPS.com. And they have a really great list of family attorneys and all the little tidbits and laws and everything else and great advice on there. They're like really Christian, but I get over it because we have a similar enemy.
Yeah, absolutely.
True. Sure. So interesting thing in the state of New Hampshire. I don't know if they have this in other states, but if you're... child is taken from you by CPS and you are a member of the church, of any church, the church can step in and take possession of the child from CPS.
That's awesome.
For 60 days.
That's fantastic.
Wow.
And so, you tell me, 60 days is a pretty long window. Any investigation they're doing is probably going to be concluded by then. No?
Okay. So the investigation stage should only last from 1 to 30 days. That's that's how long the investigation stage is supposed to be. If it's going to actual removal, it can take up to 60 days. That's just the investigation, though. Then it transfers. There's three different parts of CPS. Then there's family-based services. At least it's Texas. It depends on the state, but it's usually the same. Then there's family-based services, which is essentially, you were abusing your kid. Now you have to do all these services. That can last from 60 to 120 days.
Okay.
And then there's court, which is a separate section of CPS, and that can last forever.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But so...
They'll wait you out.
Is 60 days enough time if you've got a good attorney to get the situation taken care of?
Yes. That is
so
a good move.
At least it buys you that time.
Yeah.
So that the kid's not being raped.
And,
here's the thing. In New Hampshire, it's very easy to start a church. I have friends who started one. It's not religious based. It's a church.
What, Ian, right?
No, not Ian. But their church is based on a particular sport, and let's say it's basketball. It's the Church of Basketball. And they meet every Sunday. They have there's certain requirements that you have to have a ritual that you do, and you have to have certain things.
So they, I'm so excited right now. They have this program
every Sunday, and I'll introduce you to them.
That's great.
But you know, they have they sing songs. They have what they call a rant, you know, instead of a sermon, and and it's great. And they basically the entire point of this, or one of many, is to be able to protect children from child protective services.
That's absolutely amazing. I wasn't aware of that in New Hampshire. I'm going to throw that to every single person though at the Liberty Forum tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Jesus, that's really important information to know. Because it's funny with the church thing in Utah, I get a lot of phone calls from Utah because it turns out it's a lot of like unschoolers, homeschoolers type. And these people usually call in regarding CPS is actually other people in the congregation. They're just like, oh, well, they're weird. They're homeschoolers. So they'll call in. Homeschoolers get a lot of calls regarding CPS. It's hard for me to run into homeschoolers in other states outside of New Hampshire where they haven't gotten multiple calls from Child Protective Services.
Yeah.
Which is a big reason why I stress strong community. And I think strong community is going to be the solution for remedying child abuse, at least partially, in comparison to child protective services. As you mentioned earlier, you brought up the fact that government agents take away a sense of responsibility from the individual to society.
Yes.
Now, there's this thing in libertarianism that grosses me out, which is essentially, as long as you don't bother me, I won't bother you. I don't like that idea. I think you should be a part of your community, and if things that are going wrong, like someone's beating their wife, you should see if you can remedy that situation. You don't have a positive obligation, but I think it's part of being a human being.
It's part of, yeah, absolutely.
And,
I agree.
And I think that's really, really strong. So when it comes to dealing with child abuse, it should be individuals in the community going up to someone who's beating their kid and going, look, we're going to have to fix this situation right now. This because we want to make sure that your child is doing well, and basically trying to move forward from there. Not necessarily, I'm not going to pull that we should immediately ostracize them because they have a child. They have a prisoner in this specific case. So you want a strong sense of community that educates other individuals in the community on peaceful parenting practices, which the Blue Ridge Liberty Project is doing. Many people in the Free State Project are also promoting this. We got to thank Stefan Molyneux for kind of bringing this up to the libertarian discussion.
Yeah,
in right. regards to that. So it's a strong sense of community is what's going to be able to move us forward. And to the other point in regards to remedying child abuse, there's two giant, huge agencies that promote child abuse. Child Protective Services and public school. Take both those out. We take a hell of a lot of child abuse out in America.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Let's leave it there.
Okay.
That was perfect timing. I think you nailed it. That was a lot of good information in less than an hour.
Thanks, man.